Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And hello and welcome to History Rage, a new podcast where we invite members of the historical community to get angry, to get a few things off their chest. I'm public historian Paul Bavel, and can we all take a moment to welcome back Kyle, who for the past couple of recording nights has been trekking his way through Crete. So, welcome back, Kyle.
Yes, thanks for having me back. You're not going to get rid of me quite that easily.
I need you back here week in, week out, Kyle. You do not get away that easily, but thank you very much. Yes. Welcome back. And joining us this week, we have Second World War historian, battlefield guide, and commander-in-chief of the World War II TV YouTube channel, Paul Woodage. Hello, Paul, and welcome to History Rage.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us. Now, I mean, we first met at Chalk Valley History Festival a couple of years ago, and I know that Kyle has been a guest on WW2 TV before, but for listeners for whom you are completely new, tell us about yourself and, you know, the work that you do and the channel that you've got.
So very simply, I've been a Normandy battlefield guide for 20 years, and the work stopped when COVID came along, so I had to find something else to do, essentially, and I knew a lot of people, authors and historians, and I thought, why don't I chat to them and put it on YouTube and see if people want to watch? And I did, and people have been, and it's got to the point now where it looks like it all had a kind of a plan at the beginning, and which it didn't. It was accidental, but I'm at the point now where I set up these theme weeks where I tackle a subject. This week, we're in the middle of recording codes and code breakers. So I've got five guests on five consecutive evenings, always live. They come on for an hour or so, and we talk about their research, be it for a book, be it for a website, be it a family member. And we kind of do what I call deep dives, but not too deep into subjects, kind of picking up the stuff that the regular TV channels would cover, but only in kind of basic detail, and go to a level of detail that interests me. And then hopefully the audience will find something cool, which they seem to.
Yeah. I mean, you had Kyle on Special Operations Week, didn't you? Covering Crete.
Yes, and resistance. Yeah, he did what was going on in Crete. And I will be returning that subject in due course. In fact, I want to return to Crete metaphorically and tackle that subject because it's something that interests me. So, yeah, and I like particularly to bring in people who have different levels of experience from different backgrounds. So on one day I might have a published author of 30 books who's a well-known TV, you know, talking head. The next day I've got someone who's second year of their PhD studies who's at the first rung of the history ladder. And the next day, just an amateur who runs a website. And I like giving voices to different sorts of people because the more different voices you hear from, the better the understanding of the subject, I believe, then becomes.
Yeah, and I do have to say at this point as well, having watched a fair few of these, hats off for the just sheer courage of that Holocaust week. I mean, that was terrifyingly dark, and it is a subject that you know, people, you go onto YouTube, you listen to podcasts, you listen for entertainment. You don't go onto it to be harrowed and to be upset. And yet you embrace that. I particularly watched the one that Alina did, and I've yet to go back to watch Dr. Waltman. But yeah, I mean, talk to us a little bit about sort of Holocaust Week and how that worked for you and how you felt about doing it.
Well, yeah, as you hit the nail on the head there. I wanted to talk about it, but I wanted to do it kind of with the gloves off and really, really talk about exactly what happened to people when, for example, Zyklon B was first used at Auschwitz and what reaction it had on people and what was it, the experiences of those who were doing it and perpetrating it. And I think a lot of documentaries end up, there's lots of implication. They assume the audience knows the what happened, and they don't. They feel the need to not show that on screen or not to. And I kind of jumped in and actually explained it all, and it was tough to host, and it was a bit tough to deal with it. And the reaction was initially a bit kind of slow from the viewers, but then it picked up, and I think it was right to do it. And I was exhausted after the week, and I felt I'd kind of. Cliches, you know, the emotional roller coaster, but I think people got something out of it, and there were some uplifting shows as positivity. Particular show I did with the daughter of a Holocaust survivor and the grandson of an SS perpetrator, and the work they do to educate the public was somehow uplifting. Within a week of, I say, very downbeat subject, there was some positivity coming out of it. So it's yeah, I was very proud of that week. I think if anything I've done this year would be part of any kind of legacy, if that's a big word, I think that week would be something I'd like to be, if my channel carries on. People go, well, that Holocaust week you did there, Paul, was good. So
And you should be rightfully proud of it. And, you know, guys out there that are listening to this, we're going to put links to the channel in the show notes. And seriously, even if you're not a fanatic of the Second World War, get a few of these watched and a few of these listened to, because the just insights and the new stuff that you pick up from it is absolutely phenomenal.
Well, thank you very much. But, the fiver's in the post.
You're welcome. Well, moving from, you know, that which you love doing to that which you hate the most of, History Rage is all about the rage. So please, Paul, do tell us, what is the one thing that you wish people would just get over or just stop believing?
It's very simple. It's the fact that people come to Normandy, where I live, with this idea that the landings on Omaha Beach were this bloody disaster that was somehow the worst of the war, and it killed millions of people, and it was a tragedy and losses, and because it's patently not true. And that is the thing that I do rage about. But I want to just right at the beginning get the caveat in that anything I say about Omaha, of course, my respect is there for those who did fall, for those who didn't survive that day, for those who were casualties. But there is a kind of a level of looking at it where you have to be analytical about it and unemotional. And I think when we get into the conversation later, it's that crossing over of understanding the reality of the history and the emotional understanding of it has confused the issue somewhat.
Yeah. So everybody is thinking, you know, Omaha Beach, the ramps go down. It's an absolute massacre. Everything that can go wrong does go wrong. And we're almost back to the anthem of doomed youth that we see in the Somme with the attitude towards. And I can be as guilty of this myself as well. You know, I'm a D-Day historian, but I'm also a presenter. And there's a certain element of D-Day that does kind of need to be sold to get your audience in. But broadly speaking,
why do people think that D-Day and Omaha Beach in particular was this bloodbath? Is it literally just Saving Private Ryan and that opening few minutes that everyone goes back to? Or is there more to it than that?
It is that, and it's video games and Call of Duty and that. But it's also essentially, if we break Omaha Beach, let's say, into 10 chapters, it's the people only look at chapter 1 and chapter 10. Chapter 1 being the first wave, those very first men in the first landing craft who do hit at that time an empty beach. The German firepower opens up and a lot of that first wave are killed and wounded. And the chapter 10 is the visit everyone does when they come to Normandy, to the American cemetery overlooking Omaha Beach, where they walk among the crosses and stars of David. But actually, chapters 2 through 9 are the fact that second and third waves on Omaha Beach and the consequent waves, things got better very, very quickly. And that kind of whole area has kind of been ignored. And part of that is the industry that I am part of being responsible for that, because the standard way to come and see the D-Day beaches for the average American visitor is a day tour. So you do San Margulies Airborne Paratroopers in the morning, Utah Beach late morning, Point du Hoc after lunch, Omaha Beach, Bedford Boys, one of the units that was experienced the tough first wave landing. And then you move on, look at a monument, and you go to the cemetery. And it's about the fitting of a tour to a schedule as opposed to fitting the required history to what the visitors should take away from it. So we've been forced, in a sense, to cram the story into a number of hours that doesn't allow us to actually explain the events properly. So my own industry, myself included, have been part of the problem behind my own rage. So it's in effect, it's a self-inflicted wound in many ways.
You've done this to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've let yourself down, Paul, really.
I've let me down, I've let all the listeners down, I've let the world down, yeah.
We're not angry, we're just disappointed.
So if we've got this chapter 2, 3, 4, 5 and so forth of Omaha Beach that does tell a very different story, then, well, here is your opportunity. Yeah. So let's get a bit of the reality there.
Yeah, after the ramp drops, what happens on Omaha Beach? Or even before?
Well, the Germans open up. I mean, the Germans had brilliantly sighted weaponry with enfilading fire, machine guns, although they weren't all MG-42s, folks. That's another thing. We'll get that one out of the way. There's lots of old Polish stuff, 1908 German weapons. Artillery opens up, what have you. But essentially, the German plan necessitated wiping out the invasion at that very first moment. And despite the 85% losses killed and wounded amongst the first wave, it wasn't wiped out completely. And within 5-10 minutes, the second wave comes ashore. And the thing is, the Germans have now expanded a hell of a lot of the ammunition, because some of those positions, that there's the ones that everybody goes in, there's ones I know about where you kind of crawl in over old hobo mattresses and things like that and get to them. You see the recesses in the walls for how much ammunition these positions could actually store, and maybe they had a few more boxes in the room behind, but it's comparatively few. Some of these machine gun positions had space for, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000 rounds. Now, you guys know how many rounds, whether it's an MG-42 or an OA, it doesn't matter. Machine guns use a lot of ammunition very quickly.
And yeah, that's about 3 or 4 minutes tops.
If you're firing, of course they fire in bursts. Of course they are trying to aim, but the point is, metaphorically speaking, is after that first wave hits that white wall of steel that hits them and the smoke clears, literally and figuratively, and the Germans look down and go, shit, there are still guys down there alive on that beach. And they see, as you would have done from Omaha Beach, approximately 3,000 more ships and landing craft behind that first wave who are still funneling more and more men in. And you get to the point by even as early as mid-morning on June the 6th in Omaha Beach, where units in certain places of the beach are almost walking ashore to no gunfire at all, and they're pushing up the bluffs. Some of the positions have been taken as early as 8:30 in the morning, so 2 hours after landing. And at the end of June the 6th, the point is the losses on that beach were comfortably within what anyone would have anticipated when you do amphibious landing against a enemy-held coast. And the disaster aspect, as you said there, Kyle, has probably come from Saving Private Ryan, which has given us this idea of these blood-filled sandbars and ridges of sand there and the bodies washing up and upturned helmets. And it's not that that isn't true. That did happen to the first wave. They're just failing to get across that the second, third, fourth progressive waves didn't have that same problem.
Yeah, there's hours and hours of this battle. It's not just those...
Yeah, it goes on the whole day and beyond. It's not just the case of that single... And this is very similar to kind of what Peter Lyon was saying a couple of episodes ago. It's like when he was talking about the Battle of the Bulge. It's that everything focuses on one bit of the bulge, but actually there are whole... There are whole different divisions, positives, negatives, environments. And this sounds very much the same thing. But, okay, so if we accept it's not a disaster, but, and I know this is something that you've wanted to expand on further, do we agree that Omaha is the worst of the five beaches that's there. I mean, it's not the hell everybody thinks it is throughout the day, but it's still hell.
It depends by how the parameters you use to define worst, because Juno yeah. Beach is the one I like to talk about, because proportionally speaking, a much smaller force on Juno, but percentage wise, more Canadians died on Juno on June the 6th than Americans died on Omaha Beach. Obviously, more Americans did die, but from a much larger force. The accepted figure these days, and it is changing, the National D-Day Memorial in Bedford, Virginia, are still processing documentation. Joe Balkowski, my friend, historian, did a lot of work. But the accepted figure for fatalities in Omaha Beach is in the 900 or so area of a landing force of well over 30,000 who came ashore that day. Juno Beach, when you take away the British who were there, because they were part of the Juno Beach landing as well, you're talking about 370, 380 killed on Juno Beach of a landing force of about 11,500 to 12,000. So if you do the maths on that, you'll find that the percentage is slightly higher on Juno
yeah.
to Omaha. Ooh. Now, more wounded on Omaha. So if you're counting casualties, it changes again. Now, if you're talking worst beach in terms of the number of German weapons that sat behind it, that's sword. So it all depends on when you're explaining these events, be it in a book or a podcast or a YouTube video or a video game or whatever, you've got to set your rules. So how are we defining worst? And that's when I feel I get a bit geeky in that, but it's very important to kind of, you know, the rules of engagement, so to speak. So it is definitely not the worst in terms of fatalities. It's definitely not the worst in terms of the number of German defenders. Even the description of the German defenders gets complicated, because it seems that the history world cannot agree. They want to either call the German defenders their elite or hopeless. And neither of those are true. They're somewhere in between. They're not the battle hardened Russian front guys, the 352nd Division we're talking about, some people say, but neither are they the badly trained, never held a rifle, don't know what they're doing, old men with stomach ulcers that some people say they are.
This is one of the things that always puzzled me, because you do get this attitude of, you know, taking on the Germans in again, yet we're fighting the Hitler Youth and we're fighting poorly trained people and conscripts. They were still the Wehrmacht. They were still there. If you watch if you watch The World at War, and they have interviews there with Franz Gockel, who, you know, was, I believe, manning one of the defenses at Omaha, and you know, he talks about his experiences there, but he was a soldier. He had been through basic training. He knew how to fight defensively. He knew how to man the weapon. You know, they know what they're doing.
Yeah,
all across, you know, these Rommel, for all his faults, is not going to leave an untrained band of people on the frontier where he is expecting the invasion.
And frankly, if someone else has worked out the field of fire for your weapon, and you are in a concrete bunker, and you know where your weapon is firing, you know how to unjam the weapon if it gets jammed, you know how to put ammunition in the side of it, the back of it, whatever it is, do you need to be much better? Do you need to be able to do anything else to do that job well? You can kind of train up a chimpanzee to sit behind a machine gun if it's on a tripod firing on a trajectory. It's you know, how much do you really need to ability do you have to be in this situation? It all comes down, I said a minute ago, about how much ammunition the Germans have. That's where the German plan falls down more so than their abilities.
Yeah. One of the things that you always hear, and I will be cards on the table here, I don't know if there's any truth to this at all, but what you always hear with regards to D-Day, particularly Omaha Beach, is the DD tanks.
Yeah.
You know, mentioning no particular famous historians.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about rolling off the LCTs, capsizing, sinking, and, you know, they just don't get any tanks. I've seen photographs with tanks on Omaha Beach. And what is the reality there? What is the deal with the DDs?
Can you also explain what a DD tank is for our listeners who don't know?
Okay, yeah, well, so a DD tank is a Sherman tank that has flotation screens that are erected out of canvas and aluminium around the side of the tank, propeller at the back, kind of a wading kind of breathable kind of periscope thing, and basically they can drive off a landing craft a couple of miles away from the beach, and the pocket of air that's held within the screens means it's buoyant, it can float. You get to the beach, powered by the propellers, you drop the canvas screens, and you've got your armor on the beaches. And Sherman DD tanks, or duplex drive tanks, were used on all five of the landing beaches. And the particular story that is always remembered, which is the one you're referring to, is that one battalion to the left of Omaha Beach, so the eastern end, the 741st Tampatan, did release their tanks a bit further away from shore than they were supposed to, and 27 of the 29 tanks sunk on their way in. What they tend to not mention is the visibility of the coast was very difficult because of the smoke from the gunfire and low cloud, and they weren't able necessarily to judge their distance from the beach very well. That doesn't always get mentioned, but the thing that definitely doesn't get mentioned is there was another battalion to the other end of the beach, the 743rd, and the 743rd recognized that the conditions were a bit too rough, the visibility wasn't great, and they brought all of their tanks, I think bar one, it was 29 or 30 or something, onto the beach directly off the landing craft, and they provided massive firepower eventually to the western end of the beach. And on the eastern end that we talked about, where the DDs were lost, there were other waves of tanks coming in. Again, it's all about second and third waves that were coming in directly off the beaches. Some had bulldozer blades on the front, some had this. And so within an hour or two on Omaha Beach, there's all sorts of armor on Omaha Beach. But the way it gets sold in the documentaries that we don't mention is that they lost all the tanks. And it's not that they didn't, they did lose the tanks they talk about, but they don't mention the other tanks. And again, it's if you use a chapter analogy, they've told one chapter, but not done the ones that followed. It's the same principle. It's a simplification of the subject, really.
They lost all of those tanks, but those tanks are only a small part of the overall picture just on that beach, never mind the entire battle.
I think it was 140 DD tanks on D-Day, something like that. And I think 35 or something were lost, something. That may not be the right maths on that. But essentially, a lot more of them did arrive than didn't. And they were just the swimming tanks. There were other tanks coming ashore. So you have the Funnies, Hobart's Funnies, famously on the British and Canadian beaches. And there are other waves of armor on Omaha Beach and indeed Utah Beach. So the single loss of one unit's DD tanks has been used to kind of be an example of the whole story, which it isn't, and often gets used to kind of beat whoever the presenter of this story wants to beat with a stick. Is it the American Navy's fault, or is it, if they can, they all try and blame Monty for everything. If in doubt, blame it on Monty is kind of the rule of a lot of TV makers. So there's a nuance to the story that doesn't get covered, and that's again that's where the rage comes from, is that you see these things being, these same myths being perpetuated, you just want to go, why don't you just read some bloody books, you know?
Of course, like we're asking here, you know, you get to a battlefield tour and it's going to form 50% of the questions that you get asked. I wonder how you stay polite sometimes. Well, actually, after I've seen you in action, sometimes you don't.
Sometimes I don't. I mean, one of the things. I mean, I counted up how many Normandy tours I've done a couple of years. I did the maths on it, and I think I've done some of the stories about 1,500 times before. So, after a while, though, you're trying to be polite and objective. If someone really, really goes on about something that they believe that you know is wrong, and they're stubborn about it, it can be a bit, you know, because they will use as their source to prove me wrong a movie, or they'll use a YouTube thing they saw, or a picture they saw in a comic or something, and you go you know, you're actually standing with and talking to someone who's been studying this shit for a long time, and why would you believe, you know, a video game over me? But you know, that can get a little bit stressful at times.
Yeah, it's like that one photo that keeps getting trotted out to say that American paratroopers had beards. It's like, that, you know the one that I mean.
I know exactly the one you mean, yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So we've talked a little bit about Saving Private Ryan already. So how accurate is it, really? Is it accurate in terms of, you know, equipment, what happened, the narration, or just in terms of, you know, the feel of things?
It's a mixed bag. I think I always say emotionally, I think Saving Private Ryan gets it right. I mean, I've sat and watched it with veterans. I've talked to veterans who are on Omaha Beach about the movie. Some of them who almost kind of played in the movie because they drew from real people's stories to create the story they made for the movie. And in terms of the sound effects, the general feeling of helplessness, because a plan can be going well, but you as part of it can feel that it's completely a lost cause and hopeless and helpless. And in that regard, I think Saving Private Ryan does a very good job. What it doesn't do so well is, well, the beach is too small. It's like a 50-yard bit of beach they've got to run up, and it would have been like 300 or 400 yards at low tide. The bunkers, the weaponry is all pointing out to sea when, in fact, as I said, it was kind of enfilading. Some of the obstacles are the wrong way round. There's kind of other... They omit the houses that the whole western end of... the whole western end of Omaha Beach was a pre-war and still is a kind of a tourist village, and it has hotels and casinos, and those hotels and casinos, albeit no one was in them on the morning of June the 6th, 44, were still there, all boarded up. There are houses along the kind of what we would call in Britain a promenade, and the movie makers said, well, geez, we can't put those houses in there because it'll ruin the fear effect. When you see the ramp go down, you see this craggy grey coast, which of course is Ireland where they filmed it, and barbed wire machine guns. And what they didn't want to get across is that actually they were coming ashore in front of buildings. So they had to make these changes historically. So when, as a tour guide, I'm there, the elephant in the room is Saving Private Ryan, because if you don't mention it, they're going to. So in my case, I kind of deal with it head on at the beginning and say, okay, let's just run through how Saving Private Ryan visualizes the beach and explain why they made that change, why it is, and how you can't convey the full scale on a movie screen. And then when I've got that through to my group, I'll say, okay, now let's look at the actual history, and then we move on. But if you don't address it, you know that no matter whether there are, you know, a lieutenant general who's serving in American military today or a 17-year-old kid, you know that part of what they're doing is they're playing that 20 minutes in their head on their memory reel. And so you have to use it. As you guys know, movie imagery, and even you guys, with your living history, you can, by acting something out in 10 minutes, give people an impression of something that reading three books won't do. That's the power of the combination of visuals and audio, that you can create a memory that books don't do. So we have to just acknowledge the fact the movie isn't great, but it's there. So we deal with it.
Yeah, you can't not talk about it. It's such a huge shadow over the entire event.
You know, to be fair to them, they may have, you know, they may have removed some buildings. Battle of the Bulge removed the entire Ardennes forest.
Yes.
You know, that's a classic in movie gore.
And the kind of the mountains and crags and let's not go down that path.
But they're making a film, though. We have to give some allowances, I suppose. Yeah.
To be honest, if you watch that opening scene on Saving Private Ryan, or if you watch Band of Brothers, or if you watch The Longest Day, and it makes you think, well, actually, I'll go and learn the reality, then they've done their job, and they've done their job well.
Yeah,
I've always thought,
and I think that you brought me on to talk about this rage about Omaha being a disaster. And Saving Private Ryan was part of the story. They wanted to have that desperate scene so that they could reinforce this idea of saving one guy to take him out of this terrible theater of war where people get killed. So it was, if they had shown, because the silly thing is that the Ryan they go to rescue is a paratrooper who was therefore behind Utah Beach. So theoretically, if you were going to send someone to rescue someone who's behind Utah Beach, you would do so from Utah Beach being 3 or 4 miles away rather than Omaha Beach, which is a 15. But had they started with the scenes on Utah Beach where things didn't go quite as badly, it wouldn't have conveyed the story they're trying to do. It wouldn't have set the tone. Yeah. So even though they knew what they were doing was illogical, it had to go that way for storytelling purposes.
Yeah. For narrative, that's fair. Pacing and character development, all those all those filmmaking
things that are important. And but you know, but going back to this idea about the my rage about the disaster again, when people I see it all the time. I take people there, and these are sometimes people that I've taken to Utah Beach in the morning, or they've been to Gold or Sora with me the day before, and they've understood that those beaches also had their difficulties and their problems and had positions to be overcome. But it's Omaha is where they have this emotional reaction. It's Omaha where the bottom lips quiver and they feel this sense of awe. And, and I wonder whether it's the geography of the location, because Omaha has a sort of a, you know, the curve of the bay and the bluffs up there, and the sun, perhaps the sunrises and sunsets look better there than they do on Sword. I don't know, but it's all part of this idea. And hanging, looming in their frame of reference is this idea that it's a disaster. And what I then try and do is say, well, what do you mean by a disaster? Because men being killed in a military operation is not a disaster. That's an accepted fact. You're not going to do a landing against a fortified coast where the Germans have been building preparations for 2 years and expect no one to die. And sometimes I will use the example of Attu, the Aleutians, a year earlier when the Americans and Canadians landed there, and very briefly, a mixed force of 20,000 Americans and Canadians landed on a Japanese-held island, and at the end of the day, a couple of hundred were dead. Well, the truth is, the Japanese had left. They'd gone several weeks earlier. The 200 that died did so because they fell into what I call shit happens. There's friendly fire incidents. People fall out of landing craft. Aircraft crash. People have heart attacks. People just get squidged by a landing craft ramp hitting them on the head. So when we go to Omaha Beach and you're landing 30,000 men, many of whom are carrying automatic weapons, who are jumping off of landing craft that have weapons, that are behind off ships that have weapons that are firing, with aircraft overhead dropping bombs, then add the Germans firing at those arriving troops. Of course, some people are going to die. That's how it's going to unfold. The reality is, are the casualty figures within the acceptable parameters of what the price the Allies are prepared to pay to get their foothold in Europe? And I can guarantee you, if you had been in Eisenhower's bedroom that night when he's finally going to bed after how many hours he'd be on his feet there, after how chain smoking his way through 80 cigarettes a day and how many coffees he was having that day, is that when he had got, they wouldn't have known the estimates of the dead by then, but it probably would have been higher than it actually was. He'd have been breathing a sigh of relief. We're in. Yeah. 156,000 men landed on those five beaches, and about 10,000 were killed and wounded, which is amazing. We should be talking about Omaha Beach as part of a collective successful event, not a disaster. And again, it's not about the loss of those individuals, those 900 or so families who received a telegram that their son, their brother, their husband has been killed. It's tragic from their point of view.
Yeah, because it doesn't matter if it's 10,000 or one. If it's your one, that is the tragedy. But that itself, as you rightly say, doesn't make a military operation disastrous. It's, you have parameters. That neatly leads me into kind of the next questions that I've got, which is, do you think with all the visual imagery that we've talked about, that Omaha Beach suffers from a certain amount of, say, relativity, where it's compared with other beaches using wildly different visual cues. And we've talked Saving Private Ryan. So if you talk to people about Omaha Beach, you'll think of that ramp going down, Tom Hanks, I'll see you on the beach, and just that explosion of blood and death and gore and everything. And yet, if you think of Sword Beach, you think of that classic D-Day primary footage of him literally just opening the door and stepping out, and they just wade across shore, and you would think it was done unopposed. And of course, then you've got Utah Beach, where they're completely where they all blew off course and moved out of the artillery range and got a lot less. And you think just because that sort of stuff isn't seen and doesn't happen on Omaha, is it an unfair comparison that's making out Omaha to be a worse place than it was?
It's completely an unfair comparison, because a movie screen can only show one thing at a time. And yes, the absolute first wave landings on Utah suffered fewer people killed than the first wave landings on Omaha. But as part of the 7th Corps landings on Utah are the paratroopers, 82nd, 101st. They're part of the force. and they are dying in their dozens, if not hundreds, inland, keeping the Germans away from that beach. But you can't have both of those images in your head at the same time. Well, you should do, and we as tour guides try and remind people when we're talking about, okay, things are going well on Utah, but the reason as they move across the flooded causeways towards the high ground, they're not being mown down in their hundreds, is because the paratroopers up beyond them have done the job of killing the Germans. So, and in doing so, some of them have been killed. And then also, the 4th Infantry, who landed on Utah within the next 6 weeks, has suffered some of the worst losses of any division in Normandy because they're pushing up towards Cherbourg through crappy terrain, and a kind of third of their men killed or wounded over the next 6 weeks. So we're seeing a window of a few hours of one day, which is actually not part of the greater context.
Kind of in summary, is this then one of those kind of Titanic Braveheart issues where one reference is getting cited all the damn time? You know, are we stuck with this narrative for all eternity, no matter what we say? Is the world determined to believe this, or can we convince them otherwise? And if so, how?
I think the glass is half empty part of me thinks we're kind of stuck with it. And the glass is half full part of me thinks we can change it, but we're not going to change it for everybody. It's like what you're doing with this podcast, what I'm doing with YouTube. You know, we're not reaching millions, but maybe we're reaching hundreds. But those hundreds will maybe come away with a different understanding of the aspect that you talk about or I talk about. You know, you can't win the war, but maybe you can win an individual battle. And I think that's the thing. It's the job of all of us, tour guides, podcasters, authors, TV channel programmers, to kind of sing from the same hymn sheet and try and get across the reality of these things. But the thing is that the suffering on Omaha Beach has become a powerful trope. One of the things another thing I rage about, if I can have a second one.
Go right ahead.
is that, for example, that Facebook particularly, that someone will post some photo of American troops in World War II, and some of it's not even from D-Day, but it's labeled as D-Day, and it will say these are men on their way to their deaths on Omaha Beach. And actually, maybe it's a photo from Operation Torch, or it's a photo of reinforcements coming in 2 days later.
Or it's a photo of Great Central Railway's 40s weekend.
That yes, made it could black well and be white. That.
Yes. Yes.
And, but once a certain number of people have said on that thread, oh, God bless those brave boys, or those people died to make the world a better place, a historian who comes in, be they professional amateur, saying, actually, that photo wasn't taken on June the 6th. It was taken in, and you do it. And when I type that, I know it's they're reading it in that kind of know-it-all voice. So, did you know that photo isn't actually there? You can't then, you then become the bad guy. So many times I have gone onto these threads and said, actually, that photo isn't taken there. And then you become the idiot because you're now treading on the memory of the brave men who died. And I think that's the interesting thing is there's a need for the US to sort of hold on to this idea of Omaha being a tragedy, because they can then build on this tragedy in the Saving Private Ryan way to have the victory later on. The victory of Germany later was sweeter because the losses on Omaha Beach were there. And yet, as we know, they weren't actually that high, comparatively speaking. But
yeah,
the need for it to be tragic, somehow in narrative terms, has meant that the idea does need to be perpetuated. I didn't explain that very well, but I think I knew what I meant.
I knew what you meant. I knew where you were going. And you know, when you get truly ragey, then it's easy to lose control. I would ask you just to do me a favor, if you would, Paul, and that's when you're on your next Normandy tours, will you please just take care of a rage for me then? And that is that a cricket sounds nothing like a cocking of a rifle. Will you please get that message out for me?
Yeah, no, I don't know where that one comes from. I mean, obviously we know
it
that
comes from the longest day. You know?
I don't know where that ever idea was ever originated. There's a whole lot of things. I could do a whole list of things that you go, so where does this come from? And you try and find out. Or one of them you see read all the time is that there is a standard order within the American military that only one Medal of Honor per division. And you go, well, where did that start? I've read that so many times. A, it's not true because some divisions got more than one. But why would a at some higher. Why would George Marshall have a meeting where we're gonna put a limit on bravery now, lads?
Yeah.
Only one. Why would that be a thing? Why would it makes no sense, and yet it gets repeated. And we're in that situation, as you are with the work you do in other periods of history, is that tropes endure, myths endure. It doesn't matter how many academics tell people that Napoleon wasn't short, you know. The world has decided he was short. And so D-Day starts with the losses on Omaha Beach, and that's kind of how it is. And it's always going to, well, I think it's always going to overshadow the other four beaches, and I think we just have to play those cards, really, and yeah, move through that and say, okay, that is why people think, well, that is what people think. How can we now use that to kind of get them back on the right track and harness their enthusiasm for the subject and then turn it to the real history?
Yeah. It's not a bad thing. People like Saving Private Ryan and they like Call of Duty and all those other things. It just needs to be focused.
Yeah, it's the entry, isn't it? You know, that every, you know, we're talking today, what, 3 days, 4 days after Forgotten Battle came out about the Scheldt Estuary, and I kind of watched it and it was, I was expecting more and it didn't quite
I don't know if I dare watch it yet.
But it was all right, you know. People yeah, will pick up some books, yeah, hopefully, some of them, and they'll go, okay, I thought there were more than 100 Canadians yeah, involved in that, and they'll find out, you know. So
yeah.
That's...
So what have you got planned for the future for both yourself and World War II TV?
Well, very simply, I will have to make a decision early next year as whether I continue with World War II TV kind of as my main thing and mm-hmm, do guiding as a secondary thing, or whether the bills have stacked up enough that I will have to go back into guiding and do World War II TV as a secondary thing. I'd like to carry on with the YouTubing because I'm really enjoying it and I'm loving the fact I'm tackling more than one subject, because with guiding, there's a lot of repetition. You, although it's the first time the group are hearing it, it's not the first time you've told that story. And so I'm liking the yes, fact that now I do a show once and the next day it's something different and the next week it's another different subject. And I've kind of got yeah, excited by that. So I'm hoping I'll be able to carry on. But of course, as you know, as you guys know, you know, you've got to get assistance financially because, you know, I'm putting my stuff out there free on YouTube and I ask for patrons to help me, and I have got a lot of patrons, but you know it's not quite enough yet with the money I'm paying out on Google Ads and software and this, that, and the other. It's not really yeah, it's paying for itself, but it's not really earning me a living.
Yeah.
So my future is kind of up yeah, in the air, really. I'm kind of depending on my viewers as to which way, whether they support me more, I'll carry on doing this. If it's at the same level it is now, I will go into some guiding again. I will see. I think I feel that if we're going to use the movie analogy, is that alas, I feel there's like a final twist in the COVID movie that we haven't quite seen yet. Unfortunately, I think
yeah,
we think we're getting to the end, and maybe we are, but I'm not sure we are quite through the final twist yet. So we'll see. But
well, hopefully our market still stays there then.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, and this is the revolution of this interactivity online way means of sharing history is really so exciting. And I think the public will have a much more of an expectation about being able to communicate with their favorite authors and historians. And it won't be a people talking at an audience. It'll be people talking with their audience, and the people like Peter Gaddick Adams and James Hon, all these other people that you know and I know, that the last year and a half they've had way more contact with their public than ever before, and that's going to be a good thing. So I think we'll all be part of that. What will be next, I don't know. Well, but I think next year potentially very exciting.
Well, thank you very much for that, Paul. I mean, that's given us both a huge range of issues to both read up about and learn more about, even when we're so heavily invested in D-Day as it is already. If you'd like to see more of Paul's thoughts and his work, then you can follow him on Twitter at WW2TV. And also, as we say, subscribe to the YouTube channel, WW2TV, and we'll put links for those, both of those, into the show notes. And the YouTube channel airs its episodes and live streams on most days currently. So we hope you'll join. We'll certainly join. I hope you do too. So once again, Paul, thanks very much for joining us and sharing your inner rage.
Thank you. I've had a lot of time and yes, I want the blood pressure is now subsiding down. I'll go and have a whiskey and yeah, It's good to get that off my chest. Thanks for giving me the platform. It's a good medium. It's cheaper than therapy, isn't it?
We like to keep our historians healthy in that fact. We're doing our bit for your mental health.
Yes.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can follow us on Twitter if you like. I am at Paul Bavel.
And I'm at Kyle G History.
And you can leave comments, thoughts, and please send your own rages, because we want to know what you wish people would just stop believing. And you can use the hashtag History Rage. If you've enjoyed our work, please subscribe, follow us, leave us a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.